A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display? I eventually had to go down to the cellar. That's the display department. With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 70. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of the Year of the Sex Olympics. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. So the Year of the Sex Olympics, we're returning to one of our favourite writers, a classic writer for British television science fiction, Nigel Neal.
Yay!
Yay, Nigel. And his 1968 television play called The Year of the Sex Olympics, which was broadcast on BBC Two, ran for just over 100 minutes, and it was a colour broadcast on a theatre or a TV play strand called Theatre 625, which, as we discussed in the last show, referred to the lines of on the screen of television broadcast. So it was quite high definition. And I think, Brian, you were saying that this was probably some of the first colour broadcasts on British television as well. This was to showcase colour broadcasting for the first time.
Yeah, it was one of the earlier things, and that was part of what they were showcasing with the 625 thing, was that it was in colour.
Sadly, of course, the colour broadcast doesn't survive, so we've been watching a black and white telerecording of the show to prepare for this episode of British Invaders.
So looking into a little more of the story than we did last time, in this strange futuristic world where everything is based around TV, we see another TV high drive person, one of the elite, who works with creating background images and sets and things for some of the TV programs. He starts producing images of his own, what we would call art. You know, they were drawings or paintings of a type. And these pictures that he produces are very dark and sort of disturbing and meant to make you think. You know, they were distorted faces and things. And one of the people who saw them said, "They shudder me." And it was something that everyone else in this high drive group thought should not be done and shouldn't be shown to anyone, because they can only show people positive things and things with sex and with violence and so on. And he is taking these and attempting to broadcast them to the masses with everything else. And that leads to a tragic accident on live television broadcast.
Yes, absolutely. And it's interesting because the accident occurs during a new show that the coordinator Hugo Priest had launched to try and sort of entertain the low drives or keep them from getting out of control. And so they'd attempted this strange sort of slapstick humor show, which wasn't working. But when the tragic accident happens on live television and goes out live broadcast, it provokes a huge audience response, and the ratings suddenly leap up, and they seem to have found something that can entertain and divert the low drives.
It brings up this idea that they discuss quite specifically, that people will laugh at something bad happening to someone else because it hasn't happened to them. So when they see something very bad, a serious injury or a death happen to someone else, they laugh at it because it hasn't happened to themselves.
Yes, that's right. Hugo Priest spots this, that the audience will be relieved it hasn't happened to them, and then become excited and or even laugh at the events that's happening to other people. And he uses this to suggest a new format of television where real people will be put into situations and filmed as they try to survive in the outside world. And so they are, in effect, launching a form of reality television, what we would now know as reality TV. And Nat Mender, the young TV producer, and his sort of partner, Deanie Webb, or the woman with whom he had a child, and in fact their 9-year-old daughter, are going to become the first participants in this new type of television.
Yes, and this is when they create the Live Life show, and as they call it, live like old times. And it basically involves them being sent off to this remote island and living in a little cottage, coping with the cold and illness, fending for themselves, you know, finding their own food and dealing with all these types of things with only having a set of instructions on an audio recorder that will be automatically deleted in 2 weeks. So they have 2 weeks to learn everything from their instructions and learn how to live on their own on this island and in this little cottage. And there are a bunch of cameras set up inside the cottage. So everything they do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, is broadcast to all of these viewers, all of the load drives, so they can just watch these people doing what they do and living their lives on this remote island.
Yeah, absolutely. This reality TV concept and the characters that we've been watching produced television for the masses now become the stars of this television show and are trying to fend for themselves. But in another strange parallel with modern reality TV, the producers of the show start to introduce new elements or new challenges. And so this young TV director, the ambitious Lasar Opie, played by Brian Cox, more or less decides by himself to introduce a strange new element into this reality setting. And the consequences of that, without giving too many spoilers away, the consequences of that will produce dramatic effects for all involved.
Yes, Opie does some things there that are not what you would consider ethical. He does some rather harsh things in order to make it a more exciting television show at the expense of the people who are actually living it.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It's very strange, and it's quite a jump, I suppose, in a way, from the calm environments we've seen indoors where everything's carefully controlled, and then taking these characters out of that and putting them in the wild and seeing what happens while they're being filmed all the time.
That's right. And they have to learn basically everything, how to get water. They don't know anything about using a fire for warmth, so they have to learn what matches are and tinder boxes and how to tend a fire. They've never even seen these kinds of things. So there's some interesting stuff there. It's actually dealt with quite well.
So as you've probably gathered from our discussions, the Year of the Sex Olympics has a rather distinctive look to it, Brian, doesn't it?
Yes, we definitely need to talk about the look of the Year of the Sex Olympics because it is very unusual. The fashions are based on late 60s clothing and hairstyles, but made very elaborate. From what we've seen from some color photos, it looked like some of the characters had gold makeup on their faces and sequins attached to their skin in some places as well. And, you know, all of these very elaborate hairstyles and so on and so forth. So sort of a definite late 60s future that I think looks fairly good. It looks a little bit bizarre and absurd, which it's supposed to, but I think it works relatively well, all things considered.
And it's certainly very unusual for 60s television to show this very strange futuristic look. It's quite dramatic.
Yes, it is. And they show us this very sort of laid-back, casual lifestyle in the TV production facility that we're seeing everything in, which I think was more of a common idea in late 60s television, but it was definitely something that you could see here.
Yeah, absolutely. And as we've said, this is a society dominated by television, so not surprisingly, there are television screens, very large ones, in fact, throughout the futuristic sets. And in the first half of this play, we get the feeling that they're always watching television, and at the same time, television's watching people. It's watching the audience and to gauge their reactions and see if it's achieving its aims of controlling the low drives and stopping them, I suppose, become agitated or develop ideas of their own. So big screens and big sets, lots of stuff going on. And even when the young elite characters are involved, you know, following their own hedonistic lifestyles when they're relaxing. They still have the television screens broadcasting all the time around them.
Yes, it's always there. Something else that I thought was an interesting little touch was they had communication devices on their wrists. They were basically like a bracelet form of a cell phone. And the reason it had a definite cell phone kind of feel to me was that it was interrupting people, you know, no matter where they were, all over the place. And, you know, people were always lifting up their wrist and answering a call there. And the role it took and how and when they went off felt like a pretty accurate depiction of cell phones.
Yeah, it's a little detail, but it's an effective one, isn't it? Goes quite well with the sets and the costumes and the design features that we discussed. Another little sort of throwaway detail almost is that the elites quite obviously consume drugs, which are readily available from dispensers scattered around the TV studios, which I think are referred to as, or the ones we see are referred to as brighteners. And we see characters pulling these things almost like a lollipop out of a dispenser.
Yes, it was left a little bit ambiguous, but I think that idea is there, sure.
Well, certainly something that affects mood and stimulates their mood, and it goes along with the lifestyle of the young elite high drives. And then, of course, as we say, we've got these elaborate costumes, elaborate hairstyles, fantastic makeup. So again, what it must have looked like in colour, Brian, it must have been very impressive, if not a little garish in places.
Yes, we've seen a couple of photographs in colour. There aren't many, but there are a couple around. And it does look a little garish for sure, with lots of bright colours. But I think that was part of the point of the look, was that it was very out there. And again, this was extrapolating forward from late 60s stuff. So there were lots of bright colors and, you know, all kinds of makeup and elaborate hair styles and so on. So I'm sure it would have been really interesting to see what this looked like in color.
I guess the production team must have been trying to really sort of show the effects of color television and color broadcast and show what could be done. And so I suspect this film was in a way a sort of example for the BBC of how dramatic color could be. And I know one of the television critics who reviewed it said that if you didn't see the year of the Sex Olympics in colour, then you didn't really see it properly.
That's right.
I was in on the very start of apathy control. Yeah. I remember. That's my vice.
Vice? There's a real old days word.
I'm an old days man. A big breakthrough. And they found out the sheer power of watching. You know, it took them a long time. Old days, they always say there are things you couldn't show, things you mustn't say. You ever hear the word pornography?
Censor. That, I think, brings us nicely to the reactions. How did people react to the year of the Sex Olympics when it was first broadcast in 68? It was a critical success. It was well received in the press and on TV review type programs. It was watched by 1.5 million people on BBC Two, which certainly was a very good figure for BBC Two at that time. By some reports, a lot of people who watched it were quite puzzled, but nonetheless, it was watched by a lot of people.
Yes, there were some audience response surveys that were apparently reported as showing that many people watched it but didn't really understand what they were watching. But even so, the BBC must have thought it deserved a repeat, because in 1970, they repeated it on BBC One this time, although they did cut out about 15 minutes, I think just to reduce the running time. I don't think the cuts were made for censorship reasons, Brian.
It would be hard to imagine this being censored and there being anything left.
Yes, because as we've said, it's all in the ideas rather than the actual up there on screen. We don't see the actual Sex Olympics. We just we see the build-up, as it were, and the characters been introduced. But maybe its real impact of this film, maybe that came later, as we've sort of hinted as we've gone along. Maybe it was predicting some television to come, Brian.
There are a lot of people who have made that connection, who have looked at shows like Big Brother and Castaway and other reality shows that started in the 1990s. And a lot of critics, certainly in the UK, looked at these and thought about Nigel Neill's play, The Year of the Sex Olympics, and went right back to that and said, you know, well, maybe Neill got it right. or maybe there's some connection there.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in the reality show Castaway, with characters, you know, real people being sort of marooned on an isolated island and having to fend for themselves, seems very much like the live show, looking at it now. And a famous British TV critic and writer about television, Nancy Banks Smith, who in fact was the critic, I think, who made the comment about watching it in colour back in the 60s. So she wrote a review of the Big Brother television show when that was first broadcast here in the UK in the 1990s. And her review specifically referred people back to Nigel Neill's play, The Year of the Sex Olympics. And I suspect that sort of triggered a response and intrigued enough people to try and go back and look at this show.
Yes. Mark Gatiss, who is a big Nigel Neill fan and also a favorite of ours for his writing and acting, couldn't believe it when Big Brother began. And he said Nigel Neill was right. So he was looking at that as a successful prediction there as well.
Yes, there's interesting clips of Mark Gatiss being interviewed in various Nigel Neill documentaries where he describes almost, I think he was actually shouting at the television screen, you know, when Big Brother came on, surely this is just the year of the Sex Olympics. Nigel Neill was right all along.
There are some references to that on the extra features on the Quatermass DVD set, the Region 2 DVDs of the BBC 1950s Quatermass serials. There's a feature there that talks about all of Nigel Neill's work, and it goes into that in some detail.
Yes, that's a good point. It's worth getting hold of that documentary from the Quatermass, another reason to own the Quatermass set.
Absolutely. Now, we should talk about some of our own reactions to this in a little more detail, what we thought was good in it and what we thought was not so good in it. So, Eamon, what did you think about The Year of the Sex Olympics?
Well, it's got great ideas. I mean, it is a play of ideas. It is Nigel Neill, who we love here on British Invaders. It's Nigel Neill looking at television and looking at society. So the stuff that's going on in there is quite interesting stuff, certainly.
Yes, I would agree with that. It is a great setting of social commentary, looking at the ideas of lowest common denominator television and sex as a sort of generic entertainment, and the sort of youth culture and the separation of old times and what it is now. And also, we haven't mentioned this, but the idea of avoiding tension. And they talked about, you know, well, what is war? The younger people only knew war as a kind of tension. And anything that involves negative emotion of any sort or any kind of conflict is tension. And everything they're doing, it seems, is about avoiding tension. And that was something that that worked very well. Those kinds of social commentaries in here really were pretty strong.
And the look of the production, the look of the film, Brian, what did you think?
The look is certainly very strange. I think I like it, but it took me a while to get used to it because it is very unusual indeed. But I like that. I thought the look worked okay.
It's certainly fantastical, and they've gone out of their way to produce a good set and some interesting ideas in costumes and makeup and hair. I do wonder what it would have looked like in colour, because as you say, we've just seen a couple of surviving photographs in colour, and I think it might have been quite garish actually, or it might be now look rather garish, a bit like when we saw that single episode of Time Slip that survives in colour that does look rather jarring compared to the other black and white episodes.
Yes, absolutely. The difference here being that this really was meant to be garish. That was part of the point, was that they were looking at something that was supposed to be an unpleasant future, a future where sex on television and ratings-driven television and using television to calm people down, where these things had just gone much too far. So having things being sort of garish and over the top and the appearance of it, I think was very much intentional, where in Time Slip, I think it just sort of happened.
Yeah. Plus, as we've said, the BBC were really trying to experiment with colour broadcasting and they were trying to show something dramatic. So there was that element of it as well. What about the newspeak jargon, the getting used to this strange way of speaking they have?
I thought that was a very interesting and ambitious idea. What it reminded me of a little bit, something much newer, is the Firefly television series, American science fiction series, where on Firefly they use a mixture of sort of standard English with some Old West type idioms and a few words of Chinese here and there, sort of mixed together in a very odd way. This had a bit of that feel to it, in that they were sort of taking regular English speech and sort of mixing it up a little bit and dropping some verbs and prepositions and things that you knew what they had to be when you heard the sentences without it. Interesting idea. I like the idea, but I think it was a little bit overdone, because at points it was a little bit tricky to know what was going on because of it. While the show was quite well done in many ways, at times there would be some things that were said very quickly that were important. So it was sometimes a little tricky to get a plot point because it was just said so quickly in such a strange way. What did you think, Eamon?
Yeah, they do talk very fast in this jargon or lingo, and it does take a while to get tuned in to the way they're speaking. So for the first few minutes, you might be quite baffled. And I think we were on the first occasions we watched this. Once I got tuned in, I found it was very, it was fine and very straightforward. For me, it reminded me a bit of the young teenage sort of jargon NADSAT that was in the novel and the film Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
And I think Nigel Neal was, you know, borrowing a little bit from the book Clockwork Orange, which was published before this film. And he's influenced by Orwell's 1984 and by his own script for the television production of 1984, Brian. I think he was, you know, using elements of that and bringing them together in this quite clever way to comment on television and society.
Yes, absolutely. I think the strengths of this show were all about the world building and the social commentary. This world that Nigel Neal built up was a very clever one, and I think it works quite well and was pretty good. And some of the commentary in there also was pretty strong. Well, when it comes to the story and the characters, they're not as good as some of the other aspects. I think the story was okay, but there just wasn't that much story in it. And the characters were not bad. Some of them were interesting. Some of them were sort of generic and meant to be generic. But I think the strengths of this were really in the building of this world and in the social commentary, where the characters and the story were not as strong. What do you think about that, Eamon?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair assessment, Brian. I mean, I was very impressed with how quickly Nigel Neal establishes the world setting, and how quickly we can pick up pretty much what's going on and how this society is organised. But some of the other elements do, as a result, suffer perhaps along the way. And as you say, there are the characters who are perhaps, for reasons of the script, you know, they're supposed to be flat and emotionless characters, and some of them do come across as quite sort of flat and dull. And of course, that brings us to the performances themselves. I mean, were there any of the actors' performances that stood out to you for the right or for the wrong reasons, Brian?
For the most part, the performances just didn't stand out that much one way or another. There were some that were better than others, and there were a few moments here and there. But for the most part, they didn't stand out all that much. Although there were some good moments for Brian Cox, certainly. I think it was a good performance, as we might expect from him, as he is very good.
Yes, I mean, he dominates the screen when he's on, doesn't he? I mean, he gets perhaps more to do because he's a more dramatic character.
Yes, especially in the later parts of it, where he sort of takes over in some ways.
Yeah, whereas the central characters played by Vogel and Neve, the characters of Nat Mender and Deanie Webb, their characters are meant to be sort of rather flat and emotionless and lacking in tension. And they're in this relationship which has no emotion involved. And of course, the slight problem that produces is it's quite difficult for the actors to do anything with that. And as you know, again, harking back to another show, I had that similar problem with Julie Christie's performance in A for Andromeda.
Yes. I enjoyed Julie Christie's performance in A for Andromeda more than I enjoyed some of the performances in here. I did enjoy that performance. There were some interesting subtleties and some interesting changes there. And I don't think that was quite done to the same level in this.
Yeah. Yeah, it's tricky. When you ask an actor to do a character who's blank and emotionless, it does give them difficulties. And it's perhaps easier for Brian Cox and Leonard Rossiter, whose characters have slightly more dramatic moments and slightly more tension and slightly more going on in a way. But they get some good moments.
Yes, you also had the other woman who was working in the control room with them, Mish, who we haven't mentioned yet. And while it was a very sort of stereotyped kind of character, she was at quite a number of moments fun to watch. It wasn't a remarkable performance. It was just sort of a fun, you know, kind of absurd, shallow character, and that was just kind of fun to see.
Yeah, she's this wacky TV presenter who's sort of blonde and perhaps not the brightest character on the show, but she's just sort of like lively and entertaining and very, you know, very enjoyable to watch. It does produce some liveliness, which actually is needed from time to time in this film.
Absolutely, but really, watching this show, the characters and the performances are not what I take away from it.
No, as we said right at the beginning, it's a play full of ideas from Nigel Neal.
Captain, I had a test.
What?
A metabolic test.
And?
I don't know.
Well, that's a clever kid. Got two high-drive parents.
But not like us.
How not?
More slow and quiet. That if she got low drive.
How can she?
So if you are intrigued by this rather little-known show, The Year of the Sex Olympics, and if you'd like to try and watch it yourselves, find out what we're talking about, how can you get hold of it? So let's talk about availability, Brian.
Yes, absolutely.
So there was a black and white television recording which was thought lost for many years but turned up unexpectedly in the 1980s. And I'm guessing, Brian, that must have turned up during one of the BBC's audits of its stock when they started to, I think when they reversed their policy on their archiving.
Yes, the archival policy, I believe, was from 1978. But they certainly went through and were auditing things for years after that. So that was probably the case.
So there's that black and white television recording, and it was released on a BFI, that's the British Film Institute, DVD release in 2003. And again, I'm guessing that Region 2 DVD release was prompted by the renewed interest in Nigel Neal's work, and in particular the influence this show had on Big Brother and Castaway and other reality TV shows which were coming out in the late 90s and early 2000s. And the DVD had an introduction by a television critic and science fiction writer called Kim Newman. And it also featured a commentary track on the show itself from the actor Brian Cox. But sadly, that Region 2 DVD is no longer available. It has since been deleted, which we've come across before with the BFI's releases, that they bring them out for a few years and then they delete them. So unfortunately, if you're trying to buy a copy of that in the UK, it's going for extremely high prices on the Amazon marketplace or eBay, and it's not available for rental here in the UK either that I can find. But in Region 1, Brian,
the news is a little bit better. There is this DVD-R on demand service from Amazon.com where you can order a copy and they burn them off on DVD on demand. And they do indeed have The Year of the Sex Olympics. It goes for $9 on Amazon.com. And that is a bare bones copy. It doesn't even have much of a menu on it, but it does have the show itself. And they will ship that internationally. Of course, your shipping rates may vary depending where you are. But for $9 US, you can get that from Amazon, and it is an all-regions DVD. So if you can play an NTSC-style resolution DVD, then you should be able to play this one because all the regions are turned on. It is also available on Amazon.com's Video on Demand, so you can buy it as a digital video file that you download for $3. So that's a pretty good deal, but you can only get that if you're in the US.
Right. So that's US viewers only, but the DVD on demand, they will ship internationally, and it works out with current shipping to the UK at just over £10, I think, Brian. So not unreasonably priced.
Yeah, it's not bad. Now we should talk about our recommendations. Eamon, what did you think about this? What do you want to recommend?
Well, I have to say I enjoyed watching the program. I'd never heard of it before until we started getting interested in Nigel Neal and looking at his other work. It is, I suppose, for Nigel Neal fans and Nigel Neal completists in a way. And there is other stuff of his that's much easier to get hold of and probably, you know, other places to start. But if you're intrigued by the concepts and you're intrigued by this early take on reality television from the 1960s, then I would say try and track this one down because it's a very interesting watch. Brian.
Okay, I will say if you're looking for casual entertainment, this may not be the show you're looking for. But if you want something that has some interesting social commentary in it and some interesting ideas, sort of turns over those ideas a little bit and deals with some of these late 1960s ideas, which are not all that far off for today, I have to say. If you want that sort of interesting exercise in ideas and commentary in a television program, then I think this is worth checking out. I've watched it twice now, and I think I need to watch it at least once more to really get all of the elements out of it.
So it's a cautious recommendation from us here on British Invaders.
I think so.
It's one of the captivatingly odd shows that we look at from time to time as we put it on the website.
Definitely. If anything goes in that category, I think this does.
And as always, if you have seen it or if you are inspired to watch it after hearing us, please tell us what you think. Please email us or put a comment on the blog or put something up on Facebook and let us know about this show.
Of course. So, in summary, The Year of the Sex Olympics was a 1968 telefilm that dealt with the future of television being used to calm down and make everyone docile by filling them with all of these TV broadcasts with lots of sex and violence and doing these odd things with this for the low-drive population, where the high-drive population is creating this material, and we build this very interesting society where things are all done to relieve tension, and things have been cut since the old times, so we have this very sort of restricted, limited version of the future. And we have lots of social commentary and different ideas in this, and a story and characters that lead us through some of these things and gives us some interesting ideas, including these well-publicized ideas of what we now call reality TV being well incorporated into this show.
Okay, so please come back and join us next time on British Invaders, when we're going to jump forward from 1968 to 1998 and look at a mini-series called October, spelt with a K, which was a strange little six-episode show in which an ordinary man gets mixed up in a strange conspiracy and some interesting and weird science. So some interesting elements for us to look at next time.
Absolutely. That one involves some strange futuristic medical technology and some very unusual abilities that start to manifest in certain individuals. So some good stuff out there, a good little hard-hitting show. So you can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.britishinvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you so much. Please let us know what you think. And until next time, this is Eamon from England saying goodbye.